In Martin Luther's preface to the New Testament, he made a comment which has gone down in history about the Apostle James's epistle of straw. What he actually said in his evaluation from his preface of the New Testament says, in a word, St. John's Gospel and the first epistle of Paul's epistles, and his first epistle, St. Paul's epistles, especially the Romans, Galatians, Ephesians, and St. Peter's first epistle, are the books that show you a Christ and teach you all that is necessary and salvatory for you to know. It's rather wordy, isn't it? Even if you were never to see or hear another book or doctrine. Therefore, St. James's epistle is really an epistle of straw, in comparison with Paul, he's saying, compared to these others, for it has nothing of the nature of the gospel about it. Now, you read something like that, or you hear something like that, and the alarm bells start ringing. And more than the alarm bells starting to ring, it's a case that, what is Satan trying to hide in the book of James? What is he trying to squash in the book of James? And what I'd like to do today is I'd like to actually talk about how far from epistle of straw there are actually sections of James that highlight how God's law has got to be applied, and the correct application of God's law ready for the world tomorrow, because let's face it, that's what our purpose is. Our purpose of our calling right now is to be prepared for administering the very law of God that's been brought out in the world tomorrow today. That law has got to be written in our hearts, and it's not only in our hearts, but in the hearts of all the people within the world tomorrow as well. And there are three ways, really, that are seen within the book of James that the law is applied. And there are three ways, really, that we should be applying the law today. And those ways are, and the areas I want to actually go into today, the key areas, are physically, spiritually, and religiously. Now, these three areas, physically, spiritually, and religiously. And the one area I want to examine in particular, which I think would be a decent title for the sermon and make all kinds of people want to actually listen to the sermon should they browse the website and come across the sermon in the on the internet. I thought of calling it Sex and Violence because, quite frankly, there is a key area of sex and violence, or adultery and war, or murder, that you can actually see this being evidenced in the physical realm, in the spiritual realm, and in the religious realm as well, these three areas. So if we do turn over to James, it's just an initial, and I'll show you a little bit about what I mean. Now, physically, we'll deal with that shortly, because Martin Luther probably read this book, and I've heard one explanation as to why he didn't like James so much, is that he tended to shoot himself off at the mouth, and he didn't normally speak first and think afterwards. And he read what it actually said, talked about actually controlling the tongue, and he didn't like that very much. Now, whether that's true or not, I really don't know, but that's what some have written about Martin Luther's approach to the book of James. But here in James chapter 2, if we pick it up in verse 8, it says, "If you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well." Now, this is where the title of the royal law is coming from. But if you know, as you do unto others as you'll have them do to you, basically what they say in the world. But it's phrased as you love your neighbor as yourself here. But if you have respect to persons, then you commit sin and are convinced or converted of the law, convicted of the law, as transgressors. I want you to notice that it says if you have respect of persons. Now, that's a spiritual application. It's a spiritual application of God's law. And this is what he's talking about here. So when you actually go into this section, you read it carefully, you start to see the spiritual overtones within the book and the application. You know, Martin Luther may have read this and read the fact that if I have faith and you have faith and I have works, show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. He didn't like that either. But the works involved are spiritually based. Because it says here in verse 8, it says, if you have a respect of persons, you commit sin. Why do you commit sin if you have a respect of persons? Well, you love your neighbour as yourself. So if you're loving one person more than another person, because you respect their persons, so that you can get something out of them, then you're not loving your neighbour as yourself. You therefore commit sin. So you see the spiritual application of that. You're convicted of the law as transgressors. For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point is guilty of all. For he that says, do not commit adultery, there's your sex aspect, also said, do not kill, there's your violence aspect, when you understand the spiritual application of the law. Now, if you commit no adultery, yet if you kill, you become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so do as they that should be judged out of the law of liberty. And so the context of that passage there, when talking about adultery and talking about killing, is not physically, not in the case of physically going out and stabbing somebody, going out and shooting them. It's actually the context of loving your neighbour as yourself and having a respect of persons. It's a spiritual application of the law that's being dealt with within this section. So sex and violence is certainly a term, because it applies to the media that we have today. It applies to what we see on our television screens or what we read in the newspapers. And it applies on the impact that that has on each and every one of us in these areas, in the area of adultery and in the area of killing one another, but doing so in a spiritual way. Now, I said religiously as well, and you think, well, what do you mean about as far as religious is concerned? Well, on the other side of the page, in James chapter 4, he talks about how you lust and you have not, in verse 2, and you kill, you desire to have and cannot obtain, you fight and war, you have not because you ask not, you ask and receive not because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lusts. You adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Now, he's not using adulterer and adulteress as somebody who's lusting after another white person's wife. He's using it in a religious sense. He's saying an adulterer and adulteress is that you're departing from the true God and the true God and his ways, and you're going in another direction. You're having idols that you're setting up for yourself. So he's applying it in a religious sense. So this is where I say the three areas that I want to go into today and show that far from being an epistle of straw, James actually deals with those areas to a large degree within his epistle. That those three areas are physically, that the law and the keeping of that law physically is important. And when I go into the physically, I'm going to talk about how it's mentally kept, but it's also spiritually applied. What goes on in our heads, because you mentally keeping the law, we'll examine that in a little while, but spiritually keeping it within our heads, what goes on in our heads, and religiously applying it as far as our relationship with God is concerned as well. And the reason for doing it is because the purpose of our calling now is to understand God's law, to get to real grips with God's law. And I know I go over and over and over and over it, but Mr. Armstrong went over and over and over and over the two trees. And it really is vital that we understand how to apply God's law and how to apply it according to its spiritual implication, and religiously as well. Now, the physical aspect of sex and violence or adultery and murder, it destroys society. It destroys society in many, many areas. And it's not just a case of destroying society if somebody physically goes out and commits adultery or physically goes out and murders somebody. Of course, that will. Both of those events will, in fact, cause people to destroy the society that they're in. They're calling it destruction of the society, destruction of family life, destruction of parents and children and so on. But also the intent to murder is also important, and that is recognized within natural societies. In physical societies, the intent to do something is also recognizable. Let's take an example. Let's talk about David, King David, when he committed adultery with Bathsheba. And then he had Uriah murdered Uriah, killed. Now, he didn't actually go and get the sword out himself and stab Uriah. But did he not kill him? He conspired together. He conspired to have him killed. In fact, you find this, you put your notes, 2 Samuel 11, where you find that example. But turn over to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. Because here in Mark chapter 10, we find a passage which is mentioned in Matthew as well. Over in Mark chapter 10, verse 17, it says, "And when he was gone forth into the way, there came one running and kneeled to him and asked him, 'Good master, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?' And Jesus said to him, 'Why do you call me good? There's none good but one, that is God. You know the commandments.'" Now he therefore starts giving the commandments, because it's the commandments that define righteousness. "You know the commandments: do not commit adultery, do not kill, do not steal, do not bear false witness, defraud not, honor your father and mother." Now I want you to notice, defraud not. What is it? Well, it's the commandment about covetousness. So the actual physical application, if you look at it as a physical application, is the physical application of covetousness. Now we understand that that has got to be applied in a spiritual application. So that what goes on in our heads in a very private, personal way, the spiritual way, is also kept under the law of God. And we've got to, you know, God knows what goes on in our minds. But in a physical way, in a physical realm, in the physical society, defrauding, you know, the way David conspired together to get with Joab, wasn't it, to go ahead and have Uriah killed. He didn't actually go ahead and physically have him killed, but he was guilty under the law of coveting to get him killed. He was coveting to get him killed. That's what he was basically doing. And defraud not, the way in which Christ puts it in here, is a mirror of the covetous process. Turn back to Leviticus 19, and we can actually see an application of this law. Leviticus 19, and how you can covet to defraud somebody of something. Leviticus 19, verse 11, and it's actually dealt in one of the statutes. It says, "You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie to one to another." Now, I want you to notice that. You shall not steal, deal falsely, or lie one to another. Now, what he's going to give as an example, and also, "You shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Eternal." In other words, you don't give the impression on something when you really, in your heart, you're trying to get something else. And what's he talking about? "You shall not defraud your neighbor." That's what Christ was talking about, defrauding. And how do you defraud him? "Neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with you all night until the morning." In other words, you don't keep something back to kind of bind somebody into servitude, which it happens repeatedly in this world. You bind somebody into servitude, and somewhere like India, this is a very common practice. And in third world countries, then they'll withhold amount of wages that has got to be paid to them so that they daren't leave. And that happens over and over and over again. It happens in the West as well. It happens in the West, the pension pot. You leave, you lose your pension pot. The same kind of basic principle is applied. And this is something that you find here. Now, have they actually robbed? Have they actually stolen the money? Well, no, they haven't actually stolen the money. But they're defrauding. They're going in that direction. They're wanting to aim in that direction. And this is a carnal commandment. This is a carnal way of applying the law. And you've got to understand that when you look at the physical adultery, a physical murder, it's not just stabbing somebody with a knife, it is also conspiring to do so, conspiring to cause somebody some ill. It's criminal intent. That's what it basically boils down to. Let me read you an example I thought was quite interesting. This was a case was May the 7th, 2012. Says, in a scene on Friday that echoed a plot line from the film Minority Report. Now, Minority Report is a film which set in the future, I think 2050 or something, where they reckon that they can tell when whether people are about to go ahead and commit a crime. So they're assessing whether somebody's thinking about it. And therefore the police, you know, they've got this wonderful way of assessment, and they could therefore watch body movements and therefore assess whether in fact somebody was going to commit a crime or not. So, echoed a plotline from the film Minority Report, the CPCS defence attorney, Ethan Yakovitz, moved that a charge against his client should be dismissed on the grounds that the state would essentially be criminalising a state of mind. Both sides in the case agreed that the defendant, charged with the attempt to commit a crime, seems to have been preparing to rob a bank in Weymouth. Acknowledging a witness and police report that describes a man sitting in the bank's parking lot with a mask, wig, knife, rags obscuring his license plate, and a note for the teller. Yakovitz argued that the man would have had to have gone into the bank and passed the said note in order to establish the probable cause necessary for the state to make that charge. In other words, he just happened to be sitting outside with a mask, a wig, a knife, a rags obscuring the license plate, and a note for the teller, basically he was saying. That even if you have a note, a mask, and other accoutrements for robbing a bank, that his defendant should not be charged on the basis that he might have only been close to doing something stupid. Assistant District Attorney Adam Lely, on behalf of the Commonwealth, countered that the man's reason for abandoning his plan and driving away before being eventually pulled over was not, quote, an act of volition, unquote, but because as he was preparing to enter the building, an officer parked in a masked police cruiser across the street. So this is the way, in fact, so the assessment, but what did he do? He didn't actually go in there and rob anything. So is he guilty or is he not? Well, I just wonder, he says, what's the line? Where does the intent become a criminal act? Now, there was actually a video of the deliberations of the judge and various things like this, and I tried to download it, and it wouldn't. My speed of my internet wasn't up to it, or the speed of their servers weren't up to it, so I'm not quite sure 100% what the verdict was on this particular case. But I've got a sneaky suspicion he got away with it, because he wouldn't have called him a man. It would have said, you know, Joe Blow, because if he'd been actually prosecuted for it. So chances are he actually got away with it, and he happened to be sitting out in a bank's parking lot with a mask, wig, knife, rags obscuring the license plate, note to the teller, but he didn't actually go in and do it. But what does God's law say? Well, basically, it's very clear that he was coveting to rob the bank. He was coveting to rob the bank, and he admits he was coveting to rob the bank, but he might not have gone ahead and he drove away from it. He didn't actually do it, and but that wouldn't stand up in the court of law as far as God is concerned. But turn over to Exodus 20. You see, these kind of things you and I are going to have to be judging in the future. Now, yes, great, you know, how much will we be able to discern the thoughts and the intent of the heart? How much will we be able to do that on the spiritual basis? And certainly, you know, that will give us more than an edge. It'll give us the righteous judgment that humanly you can't have. But we've still got to apply this same principle. This same principle is still applied in our lives today. Here in Exodus 20, it's not just a case that you shall not steal, or that you shall not kill. You shall not steal, verse 15, and shall not kill, verse 13, or shall not commit adultery, verse 14. But it says, you shall not covet, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or a manservant, maidservant, ox, or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's, or the money that's in his bank account. You know, and if that can be demonstrated by the actions, then we see that that is the, you know, that's a valid way. Physically, now I'm talking about the physical application of God's law can be physically applied, and should have been physically applied within ancient Israel. Now, what we see in our society today is in the areas of sex and violence, This basic concept, in the past, society understood that you're coveting to do something. It's not good for society. And yet today, it seems we've lost our senses, quite frankly. And we are going in a direction which is just totally alien to that concept. And we need to understand that what we are actually seeing today, in other words, how can somebody that is caught with a mask, a wig, knife, rags obscuring his license plate, and a note for the teller, sitting in a bank's car parking lot that drives away when a police cruiser happens to arrive on the scene, get away with it? It appears as if he did. You know, how can you do that if you write assessments? Well, again, when you're looking at sex and violence within the media, within the film industry and so on, you find articles like this one from the Daily Mail of 2007 that appears on our website. Censors admit that they no longer cut the violence out of the movies. Film censors were accused last night of being completely out of touch after they admitted that they no longer cut violent scenes from an 18-rated movie. Critics said the British Board of Films Classification members had adopted a policy of anything goes and were a law unto themselves. The controversy was triggered by a board's decision to approve the ultra-violent film Eastern Promise without any cuts. The 18 certificate movie, which is released this week, includes graphic scenes of throat slitting, child prostitution, a man having his eye gouged out. A spokesman for the board said it was up to adults to decide what they wanted to watch, and the moviegoers were free to look away from the screen. Well, you know you're not free to look away from the screen, because most of these movies, what happens is these kind of things suddenly burst onto the screen and it's over before you, or at least you've got it in your mind before you can look away. That's the problem. And there's a certain responsibility necessary within the government, but the government has lost its way. Government no longer has, the bishops have lost their way, the church has lost its way, the entire society has lost its way. It says, but John Beer, pressure group Media Watch UK, said that the board should be sacked for failing to show leadership at a time, quote, not quote, but what he says, when street violence is spiralling. Where's the street violence coming from? Well, from the sex and violence that you find within the movies. And this is how it has an effect on you and me. It has an effect on you and me. This is part of the reason for giving the sermon, is that we need to correctly administer this within the future, but we ourselves are like frogs in a boiling pot. We are getting affected by it. He then gives milestones in 70 years of censorship. In 1937, apparently, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the enchanted forest scenes were deemed unsuitable for nervous children. You wouldn't have anything like that today. Yes, so the censors actually adapted or changed the enchanted forest scene within Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Gone in the Wind, with the Wind, the Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn, was removed, it was cleared in the US after special appeal. It had a special appeal, that's in 1939. Contrast that with today, and it goes down, you know, point after point all the way through until you finally get to today. In 2004, 9 songs featured real sex but granted an 18 certificates with no cuts. In 2006, Districted. It was a series of pornographic films passed uncut by the BBFC as a, quote, work of art not intended to arouse. You know, they're beyond. But the mind has become twisted. The mind has become, in a sense, that it cannot see right from wrong. But in a physical society, if you want to destroy society, these are the areas that you attack. Because these areas are, within an ordinary physical society, as I say, the law of not defrauding, plotting to with criminal intent, that is all part of the society that we should be seeing, and certainly we do see in the past. Now, when you come into the spiritual side of things, you see, it's what God says, is that as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. So it's what's going on within our head. where no one can actually see. And that's really, you know, I say no one can see. Yes, somebody can see. That's God himself can see. And God and Christ know what's going on. The Spirit of God searches out the deep things of God. If you turn over to Matthew 22, as was brought out in by the book of James about the royal law, you love your neighbour as yourself. But Matthew 22, again, that is coming. The book of James is written on the foundation of the words of Christ here in Matthew 22, verse 34. But when the Pharisees had heard that he'd put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together, and one of them, which was a lawyer, asked him a question, tempting him and saying, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" Now, the law, presumably they were talking about the Ten Commandments, but he sidestepped it. He said, Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and the great commandment. And the second is like unto it." So he immediately went on to the second, because basically the two stand and fall together. It's an attitude of mind that is being talked about. "You shall love your neighbour as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." The whole law and the prophets, the whole Pentateuch, and also the prophets as well. Now, we are affected by the media that we watch. And unfortunately, as I said, many times these things will come through with such rapidity that it's through you. You've got them in your mind. You've got the image there before you can realize what's going on. And it's important that we choose what we watch carefully. Turn over to Matthew chapter 5. Because in Matthew 5, Christ again lays down the spiritual application of the law. How this law is to be applied. How these two great laws are therefore magnified within the overall law of God. It says in verse 17, it says, "Do not think that I'm come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fill to the brim." That's what the word means. Fulfill, in that case, is fill to the brim. "For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will in no way pass from the law until all be brought to pass." The fulfill there is a different word. It's being brought to pass. So when all said and done, that's when there's no humans on earth, they're all converted to spirit beings, that's when the law of something like adultery will change. But until that happens, not one jot or one tittle shall by any way pass from the law. "Whoever therefore shall break one of the least or short commandments and shall teach men so, he'll be called least by those," the ellipses is, "by those in the kingdom of heaven," because he won't be there. "Whoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not even be there." You're not going to be in the kingdom of heaven. So the spirit of the law is absolutely vital. And he then goes into two laws that really encapsulate that, which is why I've entitled the sermon Sex and Violence. Because he says, "You've heard it said of old time, you shall not kill." And, kill is the ultimate violence. "You shall not kill, and whoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever shall say to his brother, raka, which means worthless, shall be in danger of the council." Now, again, being a respecter of persons, if you're respecting a person, it's the one you give credit to, and the others you despise. This, therefore, disobeys the law against killing. It disobeys the spirit of the law. It says, "Whoever says to your brother, raka, or worthless, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever say you fool," in other words, you're totally useless, you completely... You're a cursed fool. You're totally useless. "Shall be in danger of hell fire, Gehenna fire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go your way and reconcile to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." That's the way you apply the spiritual application of this principle that, you know, you don't kill. You don't kill, well, you reconcile with your brother. Agree with your adversary quickly, while you're in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you to the officer, and you be cast into prison. Truly, I say to you, you shall by no means come out of there until you've paid the uttermost farthing. But you've heard it said of old time that you shall not commit adultery. So there is the one about kill. That's the magnification of the law about killing. It's just despising somebody. You're tearing somebody down because it's the intent to kill. It's the intent to lower somebody and, you know, drag them down from where they were. And it's the same as far as adultery is concerned. You heard that it said of old time, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks or continues to look on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if your right eye offend you, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it's profitable for you to one of your members should perish, and not that the whole body should be cast into Gehenna. Whereas take the diligence, the steps necessary to implement this. Now, I've given you a number of times the thing that sticks in my mind of somebody I know was in the church. And the children were watching television, and they would not listen to him. They wouldn't take, you know, you'd ask them to do something, they wouldn't do it at all. So he basically got the television, pulled it out of the wall socket, marched outside through the door that went outside, went in front into a window to close to where the television was, lifted the television up and dropped it. There was the children who were watching the television, they weren't listening to him. He pulled the television away, they kept on watching the television all the way. He walked outside, dropped it and smashed it to smithereens. And then he got their attention. But he says, whoever looks upon a woman to lust after her and commits adultery with her already in his heart, and if your right eye offend you, pluck it out. Whereas do something drastic if necessary. Pull the television out, drop it, throw it around over the cliff. Be careful who's on the other side. For is it profitable for you that one of your members should perish, and not that the whole body should be cast into Gehenna? If your right hand offend you, cut it off, cast it from you. It's profitable that one of your members should perish, and not that your whole body should be cast into Gehenna. So we see that killing and adultery are the physical laws, but they extend into much, much greater areas. Okay, turn over to Romans chapter 13. Romans 13. Now, the context which is being discussed here is rendering, therefore, to all their dues, verse 7, tribute to whom tribute is, custom to custom, fear to whom fear. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loves another has fulfilled the law. He's talking about relationships between human beings now. And yet it says, for this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, it's briefly comprehended. The only other commandment he missed out was honouring your father and mother. Any other commandment is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbour as yourself. So in the areas of human relationships, that really summarises the entirety of the problem. Love works no ill for his neighbour, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, if we go back to James chapter 2 again. I would put a marker down there. What I'd like to read is something on violent videos. Because the spiritual application of the law is really what goes on in our head. We can be watching a violent, in fact, in almost all cases you watch these videos, or the violent video games are done independently by yourself, sitting in your bedroom somewhere. But it says, America's children addicted to blood. This is from an article in 2010. says, extremely violent and addictive video games are polluting the minds of an entire generation of children, and most parents are clueless. Young players earn game points based on how many murders they commit, with increasingly realistic bloodshed splattered around for teenagers and preteens to learn to enjoy. This is preteens as well, it's not just teens. These highly disturbing video games encourage players to shoot innocent bystanders to win points, and to commit acts like using shovels to decapitate people so dogs can then fetch their chopped-off heads. Now, where do these guys that are actually decapitating people in ISIS, where do they, you know, how do they grow up? The British guy. You know, where did he get the kind of concepts from? You know, very good chance that it came from the. He'd be playing the video games. If you find that shocking to read, just imagine how much more shocking it is for a seven-year-old to see it acted out in gory graphics and to win points for committing such crimes. Now, if you are fed this kind of diet, is there any wonder that you get the society that we got? This is what's happening. Other scenes include having sex with prostitutes and then killing them, or committing heinous acts of terrorism. Again, within this particular game. So some games are programmed to become more violent when the game is being played, and parents usually don't or can't play the games. Again, what happens is the parent might be able to get the game and put it in, go through the first stage and see that it's relatively harmless, and not realize that as you progress, so it increases the violence and pornography probably, and yet you're not going to spend all the time doing it, but the child is. It's designed to undermine, it's designed to give sex and violence. And where is that coming from? What mindset is that coming from? Children don't necessarily know the difference between fantasy and reality, certainly when you're looking at age 70. I remember the child I've said before, standing on the side of the road, unable to really judge the distances of the traffic. And apparently, until you're about the age of 12 or 13, something like that, you don't have the spatial awareness. And the brain is still developing. It says, children don't necessarily know the difference between fantasy and reality. Brain research indicates that teenagers' brains, as well as children's brains, are still developing and may store violent images as real memories. Virtually every school massacre can be traced to the young killer's addiction to violent video games. Virtually every school massacre can be traced back to these things. And it says that a case challenging the law limiting the sale of these violent video games to children is now pending before the US Supreme Court. This case reached the High Court because a couple of lower federal court judges ruled that these games are entitled to as much free speech protection as, for example, Shakespeare, and laws limiting sales to children are unconstitutional. So you're allowed to go ahead and influence the children of others with this kind of nonsense? The video game industry is trying to wrap its evil products in the First Amendment. The industry is asking the High Court to create a new type of free speech that would make it impossible to put any limit on this victimizing of the children. Now, if that is happening and that is going on, then is it going on within the church? No, I would say you bet it is. And we need to be aware of this, that the spiritual application of God's law applies in the area of adultery, it applies in the area of murder. And adultery and murder are against the laws of God, and we will not be in the kingdom of God if we proceed down that route. So when you're looking here in James chapter 2, in verse 10, it says, "For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, is guilty of all. For he that says, do not commit adultery, it's also said, do not kill." Now, if you don't watch pornography, if you turn the television off when anything like that comes on, if you're very diligent in that area, and yet, if you go ahead and you have a video games, you put up with the videos and films and so on, you become a transgressor of the law. So speak and so do as they that should be judged out of the law of liberty. You see, there's a spiritual dimension within the book of James that a cursory reading doesn't immediately come across. It's by putting the scriptures such as these two verses here and putting them in the context that you find them in within the book, you find that there is a spiritual dimension totally lost on Martin Luther. Totally lost on Martin Luther. And yet he's got a great deal to say to the church today as we approach the end time, because it's the application of this spiritual dimension that is so absolutely vital. And as I say, you could take this and reverse it. You say, maybe you assume all kinds of violence. You will not have that, but you put up with pornography. Or perhaps you'll put up with, you'll get rid of pornography, you'll get rid of violence, but you'll put up with the kind of gossipy soap operas, and you vicariously living life within that, and with lies. And so on. On you go. You see the spiritual application of God's law. It extends into all kinds of areas. And in today's society, we've got a problem within the society itself. It is designed to go ahead and drag us down as Christians, as people who are wanting to be there when the world tomorrow arrives, and be able to effectively teach these things to the people that will come through the millennium, the tribulation into the millennium. Turn over to Isaiah 33. Isaiah 33. In Isaiah 33, it says in verse 14, it says, "The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who amongst us shall dwell with a devouring fire? Who amongst us shall dwell with everlasting burnings?" Now, there's going to be a problem when the tribulation comes. And all of us need to take careful note of this, because we're living in a society that is progressively going down. And sex and violence are the two areas which traditionally have been pushed, and the boundaries have been pushed, and are being pushed within the media. And it says the sinners in Zion, Zion is the church, are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites, the ones that say one thing and do another. I've got to be careful myself getting up here. I don't say one thing and do another. Who among us shall dwell with devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? He that walks righteously and speaks uprightly, words to convey grace to the hearers, it says over in Ephesians, and speaks uprightly, he that despises the gain of oppression, that shakes his hand from holding a bribe, and that stops his ears from hearing of blood, and shuts his eyes from seeing evil. Within the media, that's what we need to be doing. We need to be careful that we are doing that, because if we're not, we're not going to be fit, and we're not going to be qualified to be able to actually teach this in the future. How can we? How can we enjoy violence and yet teach peace in the future? It's not possible. He shall dwell on high. His place of defense shall be the strongholds of Petra. That's what it literally says. It doesn't use the word Petra. Petra is the word for rock. Selah, the strongholds of Selah, it literally says, but Selah and Petra. Petra is Greek. Selah is the Hebrew. Bread shall be given him, and his water shall be sure. So every indication is that if Petra is the place, this is one of these areas where it gives an indication that Petra is the place final training or protection. But I want you to notice, it's he that stops his ears from hearing blood, and he that shuts his eyes from seeing evil. And as I say, many times these things spring upon you incredibly quickly. We've got to be careful about what we watch, and make sure that we limit the watching as much as we can. Let's go over to Luke chapter 6. Let's pick it up in verse 43. It says, "For a good tree brings not forth corrupt fruit, neither does a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. For For every tree is known by his own fruit, for out of thorns men do not gather figs, nor of a bramble bush do they gather grapes. So if you want to have a fruit tree, you've got to have the right tree there. You want to have fruit produced, you've got to have the right tree. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good. And if we are wallowing in violence, if we're wallowing in pornography and in illicit sex, and let's face it, so many times in these movies that you'll see, it's almost an accepted thing that they, if two people meet and they quote fall in love, unquote, what happens? They end up in bed the next day. And that's basically the way it works. And what kind of message is that? That the message to the teens, message to ourselves? Is that what we want to have in our minds? A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth that which is evil. For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. And why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do the things that I say? This is where the foundation comes from. This is where the word actually originates. Whoever comes to me and hears my sayings and does them, I'll show you who he's like. He's like a man which builds a house and digs deep and lays the foundation on a rock. And when the flood comes and the stream beat vehemently on the house, and he couldn't shake it because it was founded on a rock. Is that our foundation? Or is it something of this world? Has it been corrupted by this world? Well, it will have been corrupted by this world. It will have been corrupted by this world because we're living in this world. But we've got to be aware of it. We've got to be aware of that corruption. We've got to be aware of the direction in which corruption is leading us. But he that hears and does not is like a man that without a foundation built upon a house upon an earth, against which the stream beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great. Again, why does it's the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. It says a good man, verse 45, a good man out of the good treasure of the heart brings forth that which is good. An evil man out of the evil treasure of the heart brings forth that which is evil. For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks. Where does this the various plots for the movies come from? Well, they come from movie directors. And many of these guys are weirdos. I remember seeing something in the mail this last week. I think it was in the mail, the actual physical paper itself. But it had, should these weirdos be allowed to dictate women's fashions? I should have brought the article, basically. I mean, they had pictures of the various designers walking down the street. I mean, one looked like a vampire and a Dracula, all in black. Another one looked like a bag lady. I mean, all bits and pieces of carpet all over her, it almost looked like. And they were weird. They were just completely, totally weird. And yet these people are dictating what the women need to wear for the season. And even people in the world can see, do we really want to listen to these type of individuals? Well, you look at the many of the movie directors, the people producing this stuff, and their lifestyles, and the way in which they are, the way in which they dress, the modus operandi. Do we really want to listen to a mind like that when it says a good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth that which is good? And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth that which is evil. For the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks, and the movie is directed. Choose wisely. Choose wisely. And why is sex and violence such a box office seller today? Well, what's the purpose behind it? Well, where's this all coming from? Where is this heart being corrupted by? Who is corrupting this heart of the movie director? Well, we're looking at these. It's coming from Satan, obviously. Who hates the picture of sex and marriage? Well, Satan hates the picture of sex and marriage. Why? Because it depicts the actual family of God. And Satan attacks the sex and marriage, and he attacks, he says, as a murderer from the beginning. But let's just go on to religiously, and let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. and recognize that when we're looking at adultery, we're looking at the picture of sex and marriage and the way it's being torn down today. There's a reason for it, and here it's given here in Ephesians chapter 5. In verse 30 it says, "For we are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones." Literally, we are members of his body, his flesh and his bones, because they're making them one flesh. And he's not just talking about making them one flesh with the sexual union, which is the predominant way it's talking, but it's making them one flesh and one mind, one purpose. "For this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh." It's, you know, one flesh is it's greater than just the sexual act. It's a greater extension to it. "This is a great mystery, but I'm speaking concerning Christ and the church." You know, the sexual act, if there's something that mirrors sex in the future, it's not been, the actual marriage bound between Christ and the church has not been consummated as yet. But it is still in the contractual stage, and we are still becoming of one mind. And it's a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. "Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife as himself, and the wife see that she fear her husband." Why? Because this pictures this intense relationship between Christ and the church, which is going to be for eternity. And it's going to be there for eternity. Now, we see the adultery side of things over in Isaiah 57. Isaiah 57. It says, "The righteous perish, and no man lays it to heart. The merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous are taken away from the evil to come." It says, "He shall enter into peace, but they shall rest in their beds, each one walking in his uprightness." But, now verse 3, "Draw near, you sons of the sorceress, the seed of the adulterer and the whore. Against whom do you sport yourself? Against whom may you make a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? Are you not the children of transgression, a seed of falsehood?" Now, is he just talking there about literal adulteries? Sons of this sorceress are the seed of the adulterer and the whore. Well, he is, but he's not just talking about that. "Inflaming yourself with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys and the cliffs of the rocks. Among the smooth stones of the streams of the portion, they are your lot, even to them that have poured out a drink offering, and you've offered a meat offering. Shall I receive comfort in these? Upon a lofty and high mountain have you set your bed. Even there went you to offer your sacrifices. Behind the doors also, on the posts have you set up your remembrance. For you have discovered yourself to another than me, and are gone up. You have enlarged your bed and made your covenant with them, and you've loved their bed where you saw it." So it's this adultery that is taking place, and what he's talking about is religious adultery. It's religious adultery. It's not lusting after a woman, which is spiritual adultery. This is religious adultery, where you change your gods, where you go in a different direction. "And you went to the king with ointment, and you did increase your perfumes, and you did set your messages far off, and you debased yourself even to Sheol," I presume that is Sheol, into the grave. Now, if we turn back to James, if you get your marker in James, go back over there again. We've read it before, but I think it's worthwhile just reading again to re-emphasize the fact that James brings this element out, where it says, "You lust, from where do wars and fightings come from among you? Do they come hence, and you lust of war in your members?" In chapter 4, verse 2 now. "You lust and you have not, you kill, you desire to have, and you cannot obtain, you fight and war, yet you have not because you ask not. You ask and receive not because you may ask amiss, that you may consume it upon what you want, your lusts. You adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore will be a friend of the world is an enemy of God. Do you think that the scripture says in vain, the spirit that dwells in us lusts to envy, but he gives more grace?" So you see again, what's James saying? He's pointing out not just the spiritual adultery, where somebody is lusting after his neighbor's wife, and doing it in his mind, say, through pornography or whatever. But the religious adultery is also being brought out. This is what Christ also recognized. If you turn over to Matthew chapter 12, where it says in verse 38, "And certain of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, Master, we would see a sign from you." And they've brought this out in the update this week, that signs and wonders. Matthew chapter 12, verse 39 now. "But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." So it's not just evil, it's adulterous. It's going in a way which is the way in which Christ actually married Israel of old. The same basic principle applies to us today, that if we go in a way away from God, we're going in an adulterous relationship. "Seeks after a sign, there shall no sign be given it but the sign of the prophet Jonah." So, religiously, adultery is certainly an area that we need to be aware of, but there's also murder as well. If we turn over to John chapter 8, and this is something that we've witnessed in the past, and undoubtedly we'll witness again, because over in John chapter 8, and in verse 43, it says, "Why do you not understand my speech, even because you cannot hear my word? You are of your father, the devil, and the lusts of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning." So again, they've gone away from the Father, which was God, and they're seeking after the Father, which is Satan. "But he was a murderer from the beginning." And how is he a murderer from the beginning? Well, which beginning are we actually looking at? If you go back to the beginning of man, he enticed Eve and also influenced Adam via Eve, and thereby caused death to enter into the world. So he's a murderer. You're dying. If you take that tree, then dying you will die. And he engineered, he conspired to do that, to kill our forefathers. So Adam and Eve, but also probably earlier as well, in the demonic world, in the mentally, you're looking at a mentality that is here. "He was a murderer from the beginning and didn't abide in the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks his own, because he's a liar and the father of it. And because I tell you the truth, you don't believe me." But this religious murder, what was he doing? He was out to destroy Adam and Eve. He's out to destroy the what became the demonic world. And he's out to destroy the church today. He's out to murder them. If you turn over to Matthew chapter 24, and again, I brought this out in the update this week, and certainly it applies. But Matthew 24, it says, "Except these days will be shortened," in verse 22, "there will be no flesh saved alive, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. Then if any man say to you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, do not believe it. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, inasmuch as it was possible that they should deceive the very elect. Behold, I've told you before, therefore if they shall say to you, Behold, he's in the desert, do not go out. Behold, he's in the secret chamber, do not believe it." Now, it wouldn't say that unless the people will be saying that. And I've heard people actually make the comment that in the place of safety, we'll have Christ there. Well, I'm sorry, but I read this particular section here, and it's pretty clear that he says, "If they shall say to you, Behold, he's in the desert, do not go forth." Is it the case that when we are in a place of safety, that people will be starting to say there's a Christ, and you know, Christ has returned, he's in a desert place? And, you know, because it's a case that he's there to teach us in his ways and so on. When Christ returns, Christ will return, and every eye will see him. He doesn't return once and then return again. So there's no indication that he's going to be teaching us in a desert place at all. the indication is that on his return, he will have 3.5 years of the completion of his ministry. That's what I understand from the scriptures and also from what I was taught. And so be careful, because I've heard that voice within the church, that Christ will be in the desert and he will teach us. Well, again, there will arise false Christs and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders in as much as if possible, because it were is not in the original. They shall deceive the very elect. They're going to be out to deceive the very elect, to do actually murder them. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at murder. We're looking at religious murder. That's what it's going to be. And if that's the case, you've got to be aware of this. It's not just physical murder. It's not just physical sex and violence. It's not just spiritual sex and violence that we've got to guard against. It's religious sex and violence that also that we've got to guard against. Religious adultery, where the context is idols, but it also goes into different ideas, different concepts of mind. And religious murder, where, in fact, people will be out to deceive, to destroy. And Christ's got a pretty intense view of this particular problem. In Matthew chapter 18, if you turn over to Matthew chapter 18, it says in verse 1, let's pick it over there, that time came the disciples to Jesus, saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst of them and said, "Truly I say to you, except you be converted, become as little children, you shall not even get into the kingdom of heaven. Whoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever shall receive one such little child in my name receives me." So our mindset has got to be humble. It's got to be humble before God. But there is a danger. We can also become foolish as a little child, and that we shouldn't be. "But whoso shall offend one of these little ones, which believe in me, it would be better for him that a millstone were hanged round his neck and that he was drowned in the depths of the sea." So there's a pretty severe view taken by Christ of anybody that murders, attempts to murder. It's not murdering, as I said before. It's the attempt to. It's the intent of the law which is so important. And if that is the case, it's better for him than the millstone is hung around his neck. Let's turn over to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation 3. And we'll finish on this. Because Revelation 3, he talks to the people in Philadelphia. "The angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he that's holy, that's true, that has the key of David, that opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens." And we're in that section now. The work that was done before has been shut, and it's not a case of opening that work. We're not trying to preach the gospel to the world as a witness. That's been done already. But we've got a responsibility to make sure that the word is actually made available. "I know your works. Behold, I've set before you an open door, and no man can shut it. For you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Behold, I'll make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews, and are not, but lie. Behold, I'll make them to come and worship before your feet, and to know that I love you." And notice, it's always talking thee. It's singular now. The individual, it says to the angel, the messenger of the church of Philadelphia. So much of this, when it starts away, it'll be talking to the messenger, to the actual individual that is being used, in this case Mr. Herbert Armstrong. But when you get towards the end, it says, "Behold, I come quickly, hold fast that which you have, that no man takes your crown. Him that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple." It's talking to the individuals being called to a large degree. So, "Behold, I'll make," in verse 9, "I'll make them of the synagogue of Satan that say they're Jews and are not, and lie. Behold, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I've loved you." And we certainly look forward to that time. "Because you have kept my word and my patience, I also will keep you from the hour of trial that will come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take your crown." Now, if the man takes your crown, what's he doing? He's murdering you. He's murdering you because, you know, when Christ returns, his reward is with him, his work before him. And he's wanting people who are going to be ready to do that work, ready to actually implement his laws into the very heart of man on a worldwide basis, on a world and girdling basis. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which you have, that no man take your crown. This is a warning to every one of us to understand that this sex and violence is not just physical. It's not just spiritual, but it's also religious as well. Him that overcomes, it overcomes what? Well, he overcomes generally, but what's he just been talking about? The men that are taking the crown. And the foundation has got to be, again, hears these sayings of mine and does them. He builds a foundation on a rock, and the floods came and so on. It didn't actually affect it. But he that overcomes will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, because his foundation is right. And he shall go no more out. Now write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I'll write upon him my new name. He that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. So it is vital that we recognize how to apply the law in the future. It's physically, yes, but it's not just killing somebody. It's not just committing, having a physical act of adultery. It's the intent to do that also destroys the society. So physical could also include the intent, the covetousness in order to disobey God. But spiritually also. Spiritually is what's going on in our heads, what's actually going on unbeknown to anybody else, just between ourselves and God and as far as the Holy Spirit is concerned. But it's also religiously as well. And we've got to understand that men are attempting to take our crowns now, but we want to make sure that we understand that this must never happen again, so that should anything like that arise in the future, that we are able to recognize it and to be able to deal with it. That's the purpose of our time at this particular time, to understand, to learn, to understand the application of God's law in these three areas, physically, spiritually, and religiously as well. And so it is vital that we don't just do that for the future and the need that we have for applying the law in the future, but it's also vital for us to recognize things in these areas now.